His shoulders felt lighter, his head clearer, his soul was less troubled. But Nate carried so much baggage. He wasn't certain which loads had been taken away and which remained. He was still frightened by the real world. It was easy to be brave deep in the Pantanal, where the temptations were few. But he knew what awaited him at home.
"Your sins are forgiven, Nate," she said.
"Which ones? There are so many."
"All of them."
"It's too easy. There's a lot of wreckage back there."
"We'll pray again tonight."
"It will take more for me than most folks."
"Trust me, Nate. And trust God. He's seen worse."
"I trust you. It's God who's got me worried."
She squeezed his hand even tighter, and for a long, still moment they watched the water bubble around them. Finally she said, "We need to go." But they didn't move.
"I've been thinking about this burial, this little girl," Nate said.
"What about it?"
"Will we see her body?"
"I suppose. It will be hard to miss."
"Then I'd rather not. Jevy and I will go back to the village and wait."
"Are you sure, Nate? We could talk for hours."
"I don't want to see a dead child."
"Very well. I understand."
He helped her to her feet, though she certainly didn't need assistance. They held hands until she reached for her boots. As usual, Lako materialized from nowhere, and they were off, soon lost in the dark woods. He found Jevy asleep under a tree. They picked their way along the trail, watching for snakes with every step, and slowly returned to the village. Chapter 31. The chief wasn't much of a weatherman. The storm never materialized. It rained twice during the day as Nate and Jevy fought the tedium by napping in their borrowed hammocks. The showers were brief, and after each the sun returned to bake the dampened soil and raise the humidity. Even in the shade, moving only when necessary, the two men sweltered in the heat. They watched the Indians whenever there was activity, but the work and play ebbed and flowed with the heat. When the sun was out in full force, the Ipecas retreated to their huts or to the shade trees behind them. During the brief showers, the children played in the rain. When the sun was blocked by clouds, the women ventured out to do their chores and go to the river. After a week in the Pantanal, Nate was numbed by the listless pace of life. Each day appeared to be an exact copy of the one before. Nothing had changed in centuries. Rachel returned in mid-afternoon. She and Lako went straight to the chief and reported on events in the other village. She spoke to Nate and Jevy. She was tired and wanted a quick nap before they discussed business. "What's another hour to be killed?" thought Nate. He watched her walk away. She was lean and tough and could probably run marathons.
"What are you looking at?"
Jevy asked with a grin.
"Nothing." "How old is she?"
42.
"How old are you?"
48.
"Has she been married?"
"No."
"Do you think she's ever been with a man?"
"Why don't you ask her?"
"Do you?"
"I really don't care." They fell asleep again, sleeping because there was nothing else to do. In a couple of hours, the wrestling would start, then dinner, then darkness. Nate dreamed of the Santa Laura, a humble vessel at best, but with each passing hour the boat grew finer. In his dreams it was fast becoming a sleek, elegant yacht. When the men began to gather to fix their hair and prepare for their games, Nate and Jevy eased away. One of the larger Ipecas yelled at them and, with teeth flashing, issued what seemed to be an invitation to come wrestle. Nate scooted away even faster. He had a sudden image of himself getting flung about the village by some squatty little warrior, genitals flying everywhere. Jevy wanted no part of the action either. Rachel rescued them.
She and Nate left the huts and walked toward the river, to their old spot on the narrow bench under the trees. They sat close, their knees touching again. "You were wise not to go," she said. Her voice was tired. The nap had failed to revive her. "Why?" "Every village has a doctor. He's called a Shalyun, and he cooks herbs and roots for his remedies. He also calls for spirits to help with all sorts of problems."
"Ah, the old medicine man."
"Something like that. More of a witch doctor. There are lots of spirits in the Indian world, and the Shalyun supposedly directs their traffic. Anyway, the Shalyun are my natural enemies. I am a threat to their religion. They are always on the attack. They persecute the Christian believers. They prey on new converts. They want me to leave, and so they are always lobbying the chiefs to run me off. It's a daily struggle. In the last village down the river, I had a small school where I taught reading and writing. It was for the believers, but it was also open to anyone. A year ago, we had a bout of malaria, and 3 people died. The local Shalyun convinced the chief down there that the disease was a punishment on the village because of my school. It's now closed. Nate just listened. Her courage, already admirable, was reaching new heights. The heat and languid pace of life had lured him into the belief that all was at peace among the Ipikas. No visitor would suspect a war was raging over souls. "The parents of Ayesh, the girl who died, are Christians, and very strong in their faith. The Shalyun spread the word that he could have saved the girl, but the parents didn't call on him. They, of course, wanted me to treat her. The Bhima snake has been around forever, and there are home remedies that the Shalyun brew up. I've never seen one work. After she died yesterday and after I left, the Shalyun called some spirits forth and held a ceremony in the center of the village. He blamed me for her death, and he blamed God." Her words were pouring forth faster than normal, as if she wanted to hurry and use her English one more time. "During the burial today, the Shalyun and a few troublemakers began chanting and dancing nearby. The poor parents were completely overcome with grief and humiliation. I couldn't finish the service." Her voice cracked, just slightly, and she bit her lip. Nate patted her arm. "It's okay. It's over." Crying was not something she could do in front of the Indians. She had to be strong and stoic, filled with faith and courage under all circumstances. But she could cry with Nate, and he would understand. He expected it. She wiped her eyes and slowly collected her emotions. "I'm sorry," she said. "It's okay," Nate said again, anxious to help. The tears of a woman melted the facade of coolness, whether in a bar or sitting by a river. There was hollering in the village. The wrestling had started. Nate had a quick thought about Jevi. Surely he had not succumbed to the temptation of playing with the boys. "I think you should go now," she said abruptly, breaking the silence. Her emotions were under control. Her voice was back to normal. "What?" "Yes, now, very soon." "I'm anxious to go, but what's the rush? It'll be dark in 3 hours."
"There is reason to worry."
"I'm listening."
"I think I saw a case of malaria in the other village today. Mosquitoes carry it, and it spreads quickly."
Nate began scratching and was ready to hop in the boat. Then he remembered his pills. "I'm safe. I'm taking chloro-something."
"Chloroquine?"
"That's it."
"When did you start?"
"2 days before I left the States."
"Where are the pills now?"
"I left them on the big boat."
She shook her head with disapproval.
"You're supposed to take them before, during, and after the trip."
Her tone was medically authoritative, as if death could be imminent.
"And what about Jevi?" she asked. "Is he taking the pills?"
"He was in the army. I'm sure he's okay."
"I'm not going to argue, Nate. I've already spoken to the chief. He sent 2 fishermen out this morning before sunrise. The flooded waters are tricky for the first 2 hours, then the navigation becomes familiar. He will provide 3 guides in 2 canoes, and I'll send Laco to handle the language. Once you're on the Sheco River, it's a straight shot to the Paraguay.
How far away is that?
The Sheco is about 4 hours away, the Paraguay 6, and you're going with the current.
Whatever. You seem to have everything planned.
Trust me, Nate. I've had malaria twice, and you don't want it. The second time almost killed me.
It had never occurred to Nate that she might die. The Phelan estate would be chaotic enough with Rachel hiding in the jungles and rejecting the paperwork. If she died, it would take years to settle things. And he admired her greatly. She was everything he wasn't, strong and brave, grounded in faith, happy with simplicity, certain of her place in the world and the hereafter.
"Don't die, Rachel," he said.
"Death is not something I fear. For a Christian, death is a reward. But do pray for me, Nate."
"I'm going to pray more, I promise."
"You're a good man. You have a good heart and a good mind. You just need some help."
"I know. I'm not very strong." He had the papers in a folded envelope in his pocket. He pulled them out.
"Can we at least discuss these?"
"Yes, but only as a favor to you. I figure you've come this far. The least I can do is have our little law chat."
"Thank you."
He handed her the first sheet, a copy of Troy's one-page will. She read it slowly, struggling with parts of the handwriting. When she finished, she asked,
"Is this a legal will?"
"So far."
"But it's so primitive."
"Handwritten wills are valid. Sorry, it's the law." She read it again. Nate noticed the shadows falling along the tree line. He had become afraid of the dark, both on land and on water. He was anxious to leave.
"Troy didn't care for his other offspring, did he?"
she said with amusement. "You wouldn't either. But then I doubt if he was much of a father."
"I remember the day my mother told me about him. I was 17. It was late summer. My father had just died of cancer, and life was pretty bleak. Troy had somehow found me and was bugging my mother to visit. She told me the truth about my biological parents, and it meant nothing to me. I didn't care about those people. I'd never known them and had no desire to meet them. I found out later that my birth mother killed herself."
"How do you figure that, Nate? Both of my real parents killed themselves. Is there something in my genes?"
"No. You're much stronger than they were."
"I welcome death."
"Don't say that.
When did you meet Troy?"
"A year went by. He and my mother became phone pals. She became convinced his motives were good, and so one day he came to our house. We had cake and tea, then he left. He sent money for college. He began pressuring me to take a job with one of his companies. He started acting like a father, and I grew to dislike him. Then my mother died, and the world caved in around me. I changed my name and went to med school. I prayed for Troy over the years, the same way I pray for all the lost people I know. I assumed he had forgotten about me."
"Evidently not," Nate said. A black mosquito landed on his thigh, and he slapped with enough violence to crack lumber. If it carried malaria, the insect would spread it no further. A red outline of a handprint appeared on his flesh. He gave her the waiver and the acknowledgement. She read them carefully and said,
"I'm not signing anything. I don't want the money."
"Just keep them, okay? Pray over them."
"Are you making fun of me?"
"No. I just don't know what to do next."
"I can't help you. But I will ask one favor."
"Sure, anything."
"Don't tell anyone where I am. I beg you, Nate, please protect my privacy."
"I promise. But you have to be realistic."
"What do you mean?"
"The story is irresistible."
If you take the money, then you're probably the richest woman in the world. If you decline it, then the story is even more compelling.
Who cares?
Bless your heart. You're protected from the media. We have non-stop news now. 24 hours of endless coverage of everything. Hours and hours of news programs, news magazines, talking heads, late-breaking stories. It's all junk. No story is too small to be tracked down and sensationalized.
But how can they find me?
That's a good question. We got lucky because Troy had picked up your trail. To our knowledge, though, he told no one.
Then I'm safe, right? You can't tell. The lawyers in your firm can't tell.
That's very true.
And you were lost when you arrived here, right?
Very lost.
You have to protect me, Nate. This is my home. These are my people. I don't want to run again.
Humble missionary in jungle says no to $11 billion fortune. What a headline. The vultures would invade the Pantanal with helicopters and amphibious landing craft to get the story. Nate felt sorry for her.
I'll do what I can, he said. Do I have your word?
Yes, I promise. The send-off party was led by the chief himself, followed by his wife, then a dozen men, then Jevy, followed by at least 10 more men. They snaked along the trail, headed for the river.
It's time to go, she said.
I guess so. You're sure we'll be safe in the dark?
Yes, the chief is sending his best fishermen. God will protect you. Say your prayers.
I will.
I'll pray for you every day, Nate. You're a good person with a good heart. You're worth saving.
Thank you. You want to get married?
I can't.
Sure you can. I'll take care of the money, you take care of the Indians. We'll get a bigger hut and throw away our clothes. They both laughed, and they were still smiling when the chief got to them. Nate stood to say hello or goodbye or something, and for a second his vision was gone. A surge of dizziness rolled from his chest through his head. He caught himself, cleared his vision, and glanced at Rachel to see if she had noticed. She had not. His eyelids began to ache. The joints at his elbows were throbbing. There was a flourish of grunts and ipica, and everyone stepped to the river. Food was placed in Jevy's boat and in the two narrow canoes the guides and Laco would use. Nate thanked Rachel, who in turn thanked the chief, and when all the right farewells were finished, it was time to go. Standing ankle-deep in water, Nate hugged her gently, patting her on the back and saying,
"Thanks." "Thanks for what?"
"Oh, I don't know. Thanks for creating a fortune in legal fees." She smiled and said,
"I like you, Nate. But I couldn't care less about the money and the lawyers."
"I like you, too.
Please don't come back."
"Don't worry." Everyone was waiting. The fishermen were already on the river. Jevy had his paddle, anxious to shove off. Nate took a step into the boat and said,
"We could honeymoon in Corumbá."
"Goodbye, Nate. Just tell your people you never found me."
"I will."
"So long."
He pushed away and swung himself into the boat, where he sat down hard, his head spinning again. As they drifted away, he waved at Rachel and the Indians, but the figures were blurred together. Pushed by the current, the canoes glided over the water, the Indians paddling in perfect tandem. They wasted no effort and no time. They were in a hurry. The motor started on the third pull, and they soon caught the canoes. When Jevy throttled down, the motor sputtered but did not quit. At the first turn in the river, Nate glanced over his shoulder. Rachel and the Indians hadn't moved. He was sweating. With clouds shielding the sun and with a nice breeze in his face, Nate realized that he was sweating. His arms and legs were wet. He rubbed his neck and forehead and looked at the dampness on his fingers. Instead of praying, as he had promised, he mumbled, "Oh, shit."
I'm sick. The fever was low, but coming fast. The breeze chilled him. He huddled on his seat and looked for something else to wear. Chevy noticed him and after a few minutes said, Nate, are you okay? He shook his head no, and pain shot from his eyes to his spine. He wiped drainage from his nose. After two bends in the river, the trees grew thin and the ground was lower. The river widened, then spilled into a flooded lake with three decaying trees in the center of it. Nate knew they had not passed the trees on the way in. They were taking a different route out. Without the current, the canoe slowed a little, but still cut through the water with amazing quickness. The guides did not study the lake. They knew exactly where they were going.
Chevy, I think I have malaria, Nate said. His voice was hoarse, his throat already sore.
How do you know? Chevy lowered the throttle for a second.
Rachel warned me. She saw it in the other village yesterday. That's why we left when we did.
Do you have a fever?
Yes, and I'm having trouble seeing things.
Chevy stopped the boat and yelled at the Indians, who were almost out of sight. He moved empty gas tanks and the remnants of their supplies, then quickly unrolled the tent.
You will get chills, he said as he worked.
The boat rocked back and forth as he moved around.
Have you had malaria?
No, but most of my friends have died from it.
What?
Bad joke. It doesn't kill many, but you will be very sick.
Moving gently, keeping his head as still as possible, Nate crawled behind his seat and lay in the center of the boat. A bedroll was his pillow. Chevy spread the lightweight tent over him and anchored it with two empty gas tanks. The Indians were beside them, curious about what was happening. Laco inquired in Portuguese. Nate heard the word malaria spoken by Chevy, and it caused mumblings in Ipica. Then they were off. The boat seemed faster. Maybe it was because Nate was lying on the bottom of it, feeling it slice through the water. An occasional branch or limb that Chevy didn't see jolted Nate, but he didn't care. His head ached and throbbed like no hangover he'd ever experienced. His muscles and joints hurt too much to move. And he was growing colder. The chills were starting. There was a low rumble in the distance. Nate thought it might be thunder.
Wonderful, he thought. That's precisely what we need now.
The rains stayed away. The river turned once to the west, and Chevy saw the orange and yellow remnants of a sunset. Then it turned back to the east, to the approaching darkness across the Pantanal. Twice the canoe slowed as the Ipecas conferred about which fork to take. Chevy kept their boat 100 feet or so behind, but as darkness settled in, he followed closer. He couldn't see Nate buried under the tent, but he knew his friend was suffering. Chevy actually once knew a man who died from malaria. 2 hours into the journey, the guides led them through a bewildering series of narrow streams and quiet lagoons. And when they emerged into a broader river, the canoe slowed for a moment. The Indians needed a rest. Laco called to Chevy and explained that they were now safe, that they had just gone through the difficult part, and the rest should be easy. The Sheko was about 2 hours away, and it led straight to the Paraguay.
"Can we make it alone?" Chevy asked.
"No," came the reply. There were still forks to deal with, plus the Indians knew a spot on the Sheko that would not be flooded. There they would sleep.
"How is the American?" Laco asked.
"Not well," Chevy replied. The American heard their voices, and he knew the boat was not moving. The fever burned him from head to toe. His flesh and clothes were soaked, and the aluminum under him was wet as well. His eyes were swollen shut, his mouth so dry it hurt to open it. He heard Chevy asking him something in English, but he could not answer. Consciousness came and went. In the darkness the canoes moved more slowly. Chevy trailed closer, at times using his flashlight to help the guide study the forks and tributaries. At half throttle, his unsteady outboard settled into a constant whine.
They stopped just once to eat a loaf of bread and drink juice and to relieve themselves. They latched the three craft together and floated for 10 minutes. Laco was concerned about the American. "What shall I tell the missionary about him?" he asked Jevy. "Tell her he has malaria." Lightning in the distance ended their brief dinner and rest. The Indians set off again, paddling as hard as ever. They had not seen solid ground in hours. There was no place to land and ride out a storm. The motor finally quit. Jevy switched to his last full tank and started it again. At half throttle, he had enough fuel for about 6 hours, long enough to find the Paraguay. There would be traffic there, and houses, and at some point, the Santa Laura. He knew the exact spot where the Checo emptied into the Paraguay. Going downriver, they should find Welly by dawn. The lightning followed, but did not catch them. Each flash made the guides work harder. But they began to tire. At one point, Laco grabbed a side of the John boat, another Ipica held the other, Jevy held the flashlight above his head, and they plowed forward like a barge. The trees and brush grew thicker and the river widened. There was solid ground on both sides. The Indians were chattering more, and when they entered the Checo, the paddling stopped. They were exhausted and ready to stop. "It's 3 hours past their bedtime," Jevy thought. They found their spot and landed. Laco explained that he had been the missionary's assistant for many years. He'd seen lots of malaria. He'd even had it himself 3 times. He eased the tent off Nate's head and chest and touched his forehead. "A very high fever," he told Jevy, who was holding the flashlight, standing in mud and anxious to get back in the boat. "There's nothing you can do," he said as he completed his diagnosis. "The fever will go away, then there will be another attack in 48 hours. He was disturbed by the swollen eyes, something he'd never seen before with malaria. The oldest guide began talking to Laco and pointing to the dark river. The translation to Jevy was to keep it in the center, ignore the small divides, especially the ones to the left, and in 2 hours he should find the Paraguay. Jevy thanked them profusely and took off. The fever didn't die. An hour later, Jevy checked Nate and his face was still burning. He was curled into a fetal position, semi-conscious and mumbling incoherently. Jevy forced water into his mouth, then poured the rest over his face. The Checo was wide and easy to navigate. They passed a house, the first they'd seen in a month, it seemed. Like a lighthouse beckoning a wayward ship, the moon broke through the clouds and lit the waters in front of them. "Can you hear me, Nate?" Jevy said, not loud enough to be heard. "Our luck is changing." He followed the moon to the Paraguay. Chapter 32 The boat was a chawana, a floating shoebox 30 feet long, 8 feet wide, flat-bottomed, and used to haul cargo through the Pantanal. Jevy had captained dozens of them. He saw the light coming around a bend, and when he heard the knock of the diesel, he knew precisely what kind of boat it was. And he knew the captain, who was sleeping on his bunk when the deckhand stopped the chawana. It was almost 3 a.m. Jevy tied his John boat to the bow and hopped on board. They fed him 2 bananas while he gave them a quick summary of what he was doing. The deckhand brought sweet coffee. They were headed north to Puerto Indio, to the army base there, to trade with the soldiers. They could spare 5 gallons of gas. Jevy promised to pay them back in Corumbá. No problem. Everybody helps on the river. More coffee and some sugared wafers. Then he asked about the Santa Laura and Welly. "It's at the mouth of the Cabisha," Jevy told them. "Docked where the old pier used to be," he said. They shook their heads. "He wasn't there," the captain said. The deckhand agreed. They knew the Santa Laura, and they had not seen it. It would have been impossible to miss. "It has to be there," Jevy said. "No, we passed the Cabisha at noon yesterday. There was no sign of the Santa Laura." Perhaps Welly had taken it a few miles into the Cabisha to look for them. He had to be worried sick. Jevy would forgive him for moving the Santa Laura, but not before a tongue-lashing. The boat would be there, he was certain. He sipped more coffee and told them about Nate and the malaria. There were fresh rumors in Corumbá about waves of the disease sweeping through the Pantanal. Xevi had heard these all of his life. They filled a tank from a barrel on board the Shawana. As a general rule, river traffic during the rainy season was 3 times faster downstream than up. A John boat with a good motor should reach the Cabixá in 4 hours, the trading post in 10, Corumbá in 18. The Santa Laura, if and when they found it, would take longer, but at least they would have hammocks and food. Xevi's plan was to stop and rest briefly on the Santa Laura. He wanted to get Nate into a bed, and he would use the sat phone to call Corumbá and talk to Valdir. Valdir, in turn, could find a good doctor who would know what to do when they reached home. The captain gave him another box of wafers and a paper cup of coffee. Xevi promised to find them in Corumbá next week. He thanked them and unhitched his boat. Nate was alive, but motionless. The fever had not broken. The coffee quickened Xevi's pulse and kept him awake. He played with the throttle, raising it until the engine began to sputter, then backing down before it died. As the darkness faded, a heavy mist fell upon the river. He arrived at the mouth of the Cabixá an hour after dawn. The Santa Laura was not there. Xevi docked at the old pier and went to find the owner of the only nearby house. He was in his stable, milking a cow. He remembered Xevi and told the story of the storm that took away the boat. The worst storm ever. It happened in the middle of the night, and he didn't see much. The wind was so fierce that he, his wife, and his child hid under a bed. "Where did it sink?" Xevi asked. "I don't know." "What about the boy?" "Welly, I don't know." "Haven't you talked to anyone else? Has anyone seen the boy?" No one. He had not spoken with anyone off the river since Welly disappeared in the storm. He was very sad about everything, and for good measure offered the opinion that Welly was probably dead. Nate was not. The fever dipped significantly, and when he awoke he was cold and thirsty. He opened his eyes with his fingers and saw only the water around him, the brush on the bank, and the farmhouse. "Xevi," he said, his throat raw, his voice weak. He sat up and worked on his eyes for a few minutes. Nothing focused. Xevi did not answer. Every part of his body ached, muscles, joints, the blood pumping through his brain. There was a hot rash on his neck and chest, and he scratched it until the skin broke. He was sickened by his own odor. The farmer and his wife followed Xevi back to the boat. They didn't have a drop of gasoline, and this irritated their visitor. "How are you, Nate?" he asked, stepping into the boat.
"I'm dying,"
he exhaled the words. Xevi felt his forehead, then gently touched the rash.
"Your fever is down."
"Where are we?"
"We're at the Cabixá. Welly is not here. The boat sank in a storm."
"Our luck continues," Nate said, then grimaced as pain shot through his head. "Where is Welly?"
"I don't know. Can you make it to Corumbá?"
"I'd rather just go ahead and die."
"Lie down, Nate."
They left the bank with the farmer and his wife standing ankle-deep in mud, waving but getting ignored. Nate sat for a while. The wind felt good against his face. Before long, though, he was cold again. A chill shuddered through his chest, and he lowered himself gently under the tent. He tried to pray for Welly, but thoughts lasted only for seconds. He simply couldn't believe he'd caught malaria. Hark planned the brunch in great detail. It was in a private dining room of the Hay Adams Hotel. There were oysters and eggs, caviar and salmon, champagne and mimosas. By 11 they were all there, dressed casually and laying into the mimosas. He had assured them the meeting was of the utmost importance. It had to be kept confidential. He'd found the one witness who could win the case for them. Only the lawyers for the Phelan children were invited. The Phelan wives had not yet contested the will, and there seemed little enthusiasm on their part for getting involved. Their legal position was very weak. Judge Wycliffe had hinted off the record to one of their lawyers that he would not look favorably upon frivolous suits by the ex-wives. Frivolous or not, the six children had wasted no time contesting the will. All six had rushed into the fray, all with the same basic claim, that Troy Phelan lacked mental capacity when he signed his last testament. A maximum of two lawyers per heir were allowed at the meeting, and preferably one if possible. Hark was alone, representing Rex. Wally Bright was alone, representing Libigale. Yancey was the only lawyer Ramble knew. Grit was there for Mary Ross. Madam Langhorne, the former professor of law, was there for Gina and Cody. Troy Jr. had hired and fired three firms since his father's death. His latest lawyers were from a firm of 400. Their names were Hemba and Hamilton, and they introduced themselves to the loose-knit confederation. Hart closed the door and addressed the group. He gave a short biography of Malcolm Sneed, a man he'd been meeting with almost daily. "He was with Mr. Phelan for 30 years, he said gravely. "Maybe he helped him write his last will. Maybe he is prepared to say the old man was completely nuts at the time." The lawyers were surprised by the news. Hark watched their happy faces for a moment, then said, "Or maybe he is prepared to say he knew nothing of the handwritten will, and that Mr. Phelan was perfectly rational and lucid the day he died." "How much does he want?" asked Wally Bright, cutting to the chase. $5 million. 10% now, the rest upon settlement." Sneed's fee did not faze the lawyers. There was so much at stake. In fact, his greed seemed rather modest. "Our clients, of course, do not have the money," Hark said. "So if we want to purchase his testimony, then it's up to us. For about $85,000 per heir, we can sign a contract with Mr. Sneed. I'm convinced he will deliver testimony that will either win the case or force a settlement." The range of wealth in the room was broad. Wally Bright's office account was overdrawn. He owed back taxes. At the other end of the spectrum, the firm where Hemba and Hamilton worked had partners earning more than $1 million a year. "Are you suggesting we pay a lying witness?" Hamilton asked. "We don't know if he's lying," Hark responded. He could anticipate every question. "No one knows. He was alone with Mr. Phelan. There are no witnesses. The truth will be whatever Mr. Sneed wants it to be." "This sounds shady," Hemba added. "You have a better idea," Grit growled. He was into his fourth mimosa. Hemba and Hamilton were big firm lawyers, unaccustomed to the dirt and grime from the streets. Not that they or their ilk were beyond corruption, but their clients were rich corporations that used lobbyists for legal bribery to land fat government contracts and hid money in Swiss accounts for foreign despots, all with the help of their trusty lawyers. But because they were big firm lawyers, they quite naturally looked down upon the type of unethical behavior being suggested by Hark, and condoned by Grit and Bright and the other ham and eggers. "I'm not sure our client will agree to this," Hamilton said. "Your client will jump at it," Hark said. It was almost humorous to drape ethics over T.J. Phelan. "We know him better than you. The question is whether you're willing to do it." "Are you suggesting we, the lawyers, front the initial $500,000? Hemba asked, his tone one of contempt. "Exactly," Hark said. "Then our firm would never go along with such a scheme." "Then your firm is about to be replaced," Grit chimed in. "Keep in mind, you're the fourth bunch in a month." In fact, Troy Jr. had already threatened to fire them. They grew quiet and listened. Hark had the floor. "To avoid the embarrassment of asking each of us to cough up the cash, I have found a bank willing to loan $500,000 for a year. All we need is six signatures on the loan. I've already signed." "I'll sign the damned thing," Bright said in a burst of machismo. He was fearless because he had nothing to lose.
Let me get this straight, Yancey said. We pay Sneed the money first, then he talks, right?
Right.
Shouldn't we hear his version first?
His version needs some work. That's the beauty of the deal. Once we pay him, he's ours. We get to shape his testimony, to structure it to suit ourselves. Keep in mind there are no other witnesses, maybe with the exception of a secretary.
How much does she cost? Asked Grit.
She's free. She's included in Sneed's package.
How many times in a career would you get the chance to rake off a percentage of the country's 10th largest fortune? The lawyers did the math. A little risk here, a gold mine later. Madame Langhorne surprised them by saying, "I'll recommend to my firm that we take the deal. But this has to be a graveyard secret."
"Graveyard," repeated Yancey. "We could all be disbarred, probably indicted. Suborning perjury is a felony."
"You're missing the point," Grit said. "There can be no perjury. The truth is defined by Sneed and Sneed alone. If he says he helped write the will, and at the time the old man was nuts, then who in the world can dispute it? It's a brilliant deal. I'll sign."
"That makes four of us," Hark said.
"I'll sign," Yancey said.
Hemba and Hamilton were squirming.
"We'll have to discuss it with our firm," Hamilton said.
"Do we have to remind you boys that all of this is confidential?" Bright said.
It was comical, the street fighter from night school chiding the law review editors on ethics.
"No," Hemba said. "You don't have to remind us."
Hark would call Rex, tell him about the deal, and Rex would then call his brother TJ and inform him that his new lawyers were screwing up the deal. Hemba and Hamilton would be history within 48 hours.
"Move quickly," Hark warned them. "Mr. Sneed claims to be broke and is perfectly willing to cut a deal with the other side."
"Speaking of which," Langhorne said, "do we know any more about who's on the other side? We're all contesting the will. Someone has to be its proponent. Where is Rachel Lane?"
"Evidently she's hiding," Hark said. "Josh has assured me that they know where she is, that they are in contact with her, and that she will hire lawyers to protect her interests."
"For $11 billion, I would hope so," added Grit.
They pondered the $11 billion for a moment, each dividing it by various magnitudes of the number 6, then applying their own personal percentages. $5 million for Sneed seemed such a reasonable sum. Jevy and Nate limped to the trading post early in the afternoon. The outboard was missing badly and low on gas. Fernando, the owner of the store, was in a hammock on the porch, trying to avoid the scorching sun. He was an old man, a rugged veteran of the river who'd known Jevy's father. Both men helped Nate from the boat. He was burning with fever again. His legs were numb and weak, and the three of them inched carefully along the narrow pier and up the steps to the porch. When they folded him into the hammock, Jevy delivered a quick review of the past week. Fernando missed nothing on the river.
"The Santa Laura sank," he said. "There was a big storm."
"Have you seen Welly?" Jevy asked.
"Yes, he was pulled from the river by a cattle boat. They stopped here. He told me the story. I'm sure he's in Corumbá."
Jevy was relieved to hear that Welly was alive. The loss of the boat, however, was tragic news. The Santa Laura was one of the finer boats in the Pantanal. It went down under his watch. Fernando was studying Nate as they talked. Nate could barely hear their words. He certainly couldn't understand them, not that he cared.
"This is not malaria," Fernando said, touching the rash on Nate's neck.
Jevy moved to the hammock and looked at his friend. His hair was matted and wet, his eyes still swollen shut.
"What is it?" he asked.
"Malaria doesn't produce a rash like this. Dengue does."
"Dengue fever?"
"Yes. It's similar to malaria. Fever and chills, sore muscles and joints, spread by mosquitoes. But the rash means it's dengue."
My father had it once. He was a very sick man.
You need to get him to Corumbá as quickly as possible.
Can I borrow your motor?
Fernando's boat was docked under the rickety building. His outboard wasn't as rusty as Chevy's, and it had 5 more horsepower. They scurried around, swapping motors and filling tanks, and after an hour in the hammock, comatose, poor Nate was shuffled back down the pier and laid into the boat under the tent. He was too sick to realize what was happening. It was almost 2:30. Corumbá was 9 to 10 hours away. Chevy left Valdir's phone number with Fernando. On rare occasions, a boat on the Paraguay would have a radio. If Fernando happened to encounter one, Chevy wanted him to contact Valdir with the news. He sped away at full throttle, quite proud to once again have a boat that sliced through the water with speed. The wake boiled behind him. Dengue fever could be fatal. His father had been deathly ill for a week, with blinding headaches and fevers. His eyes hurt so badly that his mother kept him in a dark room for days. He was a tough river man, accustomed to injuries and pain, and when Chevy heard him moaning like a child, he knew his father was dying. The doctor visited every other day, and finally the fever broke. He could see Nate's feet from under the tent, nothing else. Surely he wouldn't die.
Chapter 33. He woke once, but couldn't see. He woke again, and it was dark. He tried to say something to Chevy about water, just a small drink, and maybe a bite of bread, but his voice was gone. Speaking required effort and movement, especially when trying to yell over the howl of the engine. His joints pulled him tightly into a knot. He was welded to the aluminum shell of the boat. Rachel lay beside him under the smelly tent, her knees also pulled close and just touching his, same as when they sat together on the ground in front of her hut and later on the bench under the tree by the river. A cautious little contact from a woman starved for the innocent feeling of flesh. She had lived among the Ipecas for 11 years, and their nakedness kept a distance between themselves and any civilized person. A simple hug was complicated. Where do you hold? Where do you pat? How long do you squeeze? Surely she'd never touched any of the males. He wanted to kiss her, if only on the cheek, because she had obviously gone years without such affection. When was your last kiss, Rachel? He wanted to ask her. You've been in love. How physical was it? But he kept his questions to himself. And instead they talked about people they didn't know. She'd had a piano teacher whose breath was so bad the ivory keys turned yellow. He had a lacrosse coach who was paralyzed from the waist down because he cracked his spine in a lacrosse game. A girl in her church got pregnant, and her father condemned her from the pulpit. She killed herself a week later. He'd lost a brother to leukemia. He rubbed her knees, and she seemed to like it. But he would go no further. It wouldn't pay to get fresh with a missionary. She was there to keep him from dying. She'd fought malaria twice herself. The fevers rise and fall. The chills hit like ice in the belly, then fade away. The nausea comes in waves. Then there is nothing for hours. She patted his arm and promised he was not going to die. She tells everybody this, he thought. Death would be welcome. The touching stopped. He opened his eyes and reached for Rachel, but she was gone. Chevy heard the delirium twice. Each time he stopped the boat and pulled the tent off Nate. He forced water into his mouth and poured it gently through his sweating hair. We're almost there, he said over and over. Almost there. The first lights of Corumbá brought tears to his eyes. He had seen them many times when returning from excursions into the northern Pantanal, but they had never been so welcome. They flickered on the hill in the distance. He counted them until they blurred together.
It was almost 11 p.m. when he jumped into the shallow water and pulled his rig onto the broken concrete. The boat dock was deserted. He ran up the hill to a payphone. Valdir was watching television in his pajamas, smoking his last cigarette of the night and ignoring his cranky wife when the phone rang. He answered it without getting up, then jumped to his feet.
"What is it?"
she asked as he ran to the bedroom.
"Chevy's back,"
he answered over his shoulder.
"Who's Chevy?"
Passing by her on the way out, he said,
"I'm going to the river."
She couldn't have cared less. Driving across the city, he called a doctor friend who had just gone to bed and cajoled him into meeting them at the hospital. Chevy was pacing along the dock. The American was sitting on a rock, his head resting on his knees. Without a word, they gently shuffled him into the back seat and took off, gravel flying behind them. Valdir had so many questions he didn't know where to start. The harsh words could wait.
"When did he get sick?"
he asked in Portuguese. Chevy sat next to him, rubbing his eyes, trying to stay awake. His last sleep had been with the Indians.
"I don't know," he said. "The days all run together. It's dengue fever. The rash comes on the fourth or fifth day, and I think he's had it for 2 days. I don't know."
They were racing through downtown, ignoring lights and signs. The sidewalk cafes were closing. There was little traffic.
"Did you find the woman?"
"We did."
"Where?"
"She's close to the mountains. I think she's in Bolivia, a day south of Porto Indio."
"Was she on the map?"
"No."
"Then how did you find her?"
No Brazilian could ever admit to being lost, especially a seasoned guide like Chevy. It would hurt his self-esteem and perhaps his business.
"We were in a flooded region where maps mean nothing. I found a fisherman who helped us. How's Welly?"
"Welly's fine. The boat's gone."
Valdir was much more concerned about the boat than about its deckhand.
"I've never seen such storms. We've been hit with 3 of them."
"What did the woman say?"
"I don't know. I didn't really talk to her."
"Was she surprised to see you?"
"She didn't seem to be. She was pretty cool. I think she liked our friend back there."
"How did their meeting go?"
"Ask him."
Nate was curled tightly in the back seat, hearing nothing. And Chevy was supposed to know nothing, so Valdir didn't press. The lawyers could talk later, as soon as Nate was able. A wheelchair was waiting at the curb when they arrived at the hospital. They poured Nate into it and followed the orderly along the sidewalk. The air was warm and sticky, still very hot. On the front steps, a dozen maids and assistants in white uniforms smoked cigarettes and chatted quietly. The hospital had no air conditioning. The doctor friend was brusque and all business. The paperwork would be done in the morning. They pushed Nate through the empty lobby, along a series of hallways, and into a small exam room where a sleepy nurse took him. With Chevy and Valdir watching in a corner, the doctor and nurse stripped the patient bare. The nurse washed him with alcohol and white cloths. The doctor studied the rash, which began at his chin and stopped at his waist. He was covered with mosquito bites, many of which he'd scratched into little red sores. They checked his temperature, blood pressure, heart rate.
"Looks like dengue fever,"
the doctor said after 10 minutes. He then rattled off a list of details for the nurse, who hardly listened because she'd done it before. She began washing Nate's hair. Nate mumbled something, but it had nothing to do with anyone present. His eyes were still swollen shut. He hadn't shaved in a week. He would have been at home in a gutter outside a bar.
"The fever is high," the doctor said. "He's delirious. We'll start an IV with antibiotics and painkillers, lots of water, maybe a little food later."
The nurse placed a heavy gauze bandage over Nate's eyes, then strapped it down with tape from ear to ear. She found a vein and started the IV. She pulled a yellow gown from a drawer and dressed him. The doctor checked his temperature again.
"It should begin falling soon," he told the nurse. "If not, call me at home."
He glanced at his watch.
"Thanks," Valdir said.
"I'll see him early in the morning," the doctor said, and left them there.
Chevy lived on the edge of town, where the houses were small, the streets unpaved. He fell asleep twice as Valdir drove him home. Mrs. Stafford was shopping for antiques in London. The phone rang a dozen times before Josh grabbed it. The digital gave the time as 2:20 a.m.
"This is Valdir," the voice announced.
"Oh, yes, Valdir." Josh rubbed his hair and blinked his eyes.
"This better be good. Your boy is back."
"Thank God."
"He's very sick, though."
"What? What's the matter with him?"
"He has dengue fever, similar to malaria. Mosquitoes carry it. It is not uncommon here."
"I thought he had shots for everything." Josh was on his feet, bent at the waist, pulling his hair now.
"There is no shot for dengue."
"He's not going to die, is he?"
"Oh, no. He's in the hospital. I have a good friend who is a doctor, and he's taking care of him. He says your boy will be fine."
"When can I talk to him?"
"Maybe tomorrow. He has a high fever, and he's unconscious."
"Did he find the woman?"
"Yes."
"Attaboy," thought Josh. He exhaled in relief and sat on the bed. So she's really out there. "Give me his room number."
"Well, they don't have phones in the rooms."
"It's a private room, isn't it? Come on, Valdir, money is no problem here. Tell me he's being taken care of."
"He is in good hands, but the hospital is a little different from yours."
"Should I come down there?"
"If you wish. It's not necessary. You can't change the hospital. He has a good doctor."
"How long will he be there?"
"A few days. We shall know more in the morning."
"Call me early, Valdir. I mean it. I have to talk to him as soon as possible."
"Yes, I will call early."
Josh went to the kitchen for ice water. Then he paced around his den. At 3, he gave up, made a pot of strong coffee, and went to his office in the basement. Because he was a rich American, they cut no corners. Nate got pumped into his veins the best drugs available from the pharmacy. The fever dipped a little, the sweating stopped. The pain vanished, washed away by a tide of the finest American-made chemicals. He was snoring heavily as the nurse and an orderly rolled him to his room 2 hours after his arrival. He would share the room for the night with 5 others. Mercifully, he was blindfolded and comatose. He couldn't see the open sores, the uncontrolled shaking of the old man next to him, the lifeless, shriveled creature across the room. He couldn't smell the waste. Chapter 34. Though he held no assets in his own name, and had been on the financial ropes for most of his adult life, Rex Phelan had a talent for numbers. It was one of the very few things he inherited from his father. He was the only Phelan heir with both the aptitude and the stamina to read all 6 of the petitions contesting Troy's will. When he finished, he realized that 6 law firms were basically duplicating each other's work. In fact, some of the legalese sounded as if it had been borrowed from the last petition, or the next one. 6 firms fighting the same fight, and each wanting an exorbitant piece of the pie. It was time for a little familial harmony. He decided to begin with his brother TJ, who was the easiest target, because his lawyers were clinging to their ethics. The two brothers agreed to meet in secret. Their wives hated each other, and discord could be avoided if the women simply didn't know. Rex told Troy Jr. on the phone that it was time to bury the hatchet. Economics demanded it. They met for breakfast in a suburban pancake house, and after a few minutes of waffles and football talk, the edge was off. Rex got down to business by telling the Sneed story. "This is enormous," he gushed. "It could literally make or break our case." He layered the story,
slowly building to the promissory note the lawyers wanted to sign, all lawyers except for Troy Jr.'s.
"Your attorneys are screwing up the deal," he said grimly,
eyes darting around as if spies were grazing at the egg and bacon bar.
"Son of a bitch wants $5 million?" Troy Jr. said, still in disbelief over Sneed. "It's a bargain. Look, he was the only person with Dad when he wrote the will. He's willing to say whatever it takes to strike it down. He only wants $500,000 now. We can screw him out of the rest of it later."
This appealed to Troy Jr., and changing law firms was certainly nothing new to him. If he'd been candid, he would have admitted that Hemba and Hamilton's firm was intimidating. 400 lawyers, marble foyers, art on the wall. Somebody was paying for their good taste. Rex switched gears. "Have you read the 6 petitions?" he asked. Troy Jr. chomped a strawberry and shook his head no. He hadn't even read the one filed on his behalf. Hemba and Hamilton had discussed it with him, and he'd signed it, but it was thick, and Biff had been waiting in the car.
"Well, I've read them, slowly and carefully, and they're all the same. We have 6 law firms doing the same work, all attacking the same will. It's absurd."
"I've been thinking about that," Troy Jr. added helpfully.
"And all 6 expect to get rich when we settle. How much are your boys getting?"
"How much is Hart Getty's getting?"
25%.
"Mine wanted 30. We agreed on 20.
There was a quick flash of pride because Troy Jr. had out-negotiated Rex.
"Let's play with the numbers," Rex continued. "Hypothetically, let's say we hire Sneed. He says all the right things. We got our shrinks. The mess gets stirred up, and the estate wants to settle. Let's say each heir gets, I don't know, say $20 million. That's 40 at this table. 5 goes to Hark, 4 goes to your boys. That's 9, so we get 31.
"I'll take it."
"Me too. But if we take your boys out of the picture and join up, then Hark will cut his fee. We don't need all these lawyers, TJ. They're just riding each other's backs and waiting to pounce on our money."
"I hate Hart Getty's."
"Fine, let me deal with him. I'm not asking you to be friends."
"Why don't we fire Hark and stick with my guys?"
"Because Hark found